This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for readers and writers by readers and writers. I'm Jules Ironside.
And I'm Madeline Vaughan. This week, Strange Familiarity, the Uncanny in Speculative Fiction.
So, this week...
This is so weird!
We messed with you a bit. But that's what the Uncanny is about. It's setting up a state of familiarity and then subtly altering the undercurrents around that familiarity so that you're not really sure what's wrong, but something is definitely off.
Yeah. I was quite pleased with the idea for that. I'm sorry. It felt unnatural for me. I kind of feel a bit weird now, a little bit displaced.
Yeah, actually. Me too.
It doesn't help that this is actually the first episode we've recorded in a month.
No, so that's also throwing us off.
That we come straight back into it and we've already messed up the system. It's just weird. So yes, the uncanny. When used to proper effect, it can create brilliant storytelling. It can create a fantastic atmosphere. When used poorly, it becomes a bit of a gimmick, to be honest.
Yeah, I think that's when it stops really becoming uncanny, doesn't it? And just becomes not just weird, but sort of because you set up the expectation for the uncanny to be there, therefore it stops being uncanny.
Yeah, and it's also the moment where things which used to be uncanny have now become so common that they're no longer uncanny. I think one of the best examples of that is the use of children's rhymes and songs for creepy things.
Yes.
Yeah, the ring of roses. Yeah, everyone knows what that is. You know, it's used in so many horror films and whatnot and all sorts of other things as well. But of course, originally, it would have actually been really terrifying because this would have been a song which was associated with innocence and youthfulness and joy, even if the words themselves were actually associated with something very, very dark, but we can talk about that another episode. The association of these songs, of these rhymes, was something joyful, energetic, and for that then to be slowed down and placed in a context which was the total opposite of that, which often was associated with death, where something unnatural is happening, where there's this kind of negativity and creepiness. I can imagine how that would really rally people up, what the effect would have been the first time it was done.
Yeah, definitely. And as an aside from children's rhymes, they've never stopped being creepy, in fairness. But dolls.
Yeah.
Particularly China dolls. These haven't actually stopped being uncanny and creepy. And I think it's all to do with partly our sort of subconscious recognition of the archetype of creating an image of something, an image of a human, as it were. There was a reason that, you know, the Puritans banned all dolls as things of the devil. But, you know, ostensibly, they're quite an innocent item, you know. You
the child only a baby good doll thing that the Puritans did, sorry.
Actually, I'm kind of with them on that one. Yeah. Damn creepy.
Yes, well done. It's the one thing I'll sort of put my thumbs up to you. Well done, Puritans.
Should have kept that one.
But yeah, I mean, did you have a doll when you were younger?
They kept trying to get me interested in dolls, but I didn't like dolls. No, definitely wasn't really interested in dolls. But partly it was a genuine... I don't think I had some of the same proclivities that most... You know, I was much more into climbing trees and probably like boys' toys and things like that. Boys' toys were always so much more interesting. But my sisters both liked dolls. I did just find them really creepy. I used to find Barbies quite creepy. I still find Barbies quite creepy, to be fair.
I think the thing that gets to me is the disproportions.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Because they are disproportionate.
China dolls in particular as well, because they are usually quite in proportion. They can look quite lifelike and they've got those glassy eyes that just sort of stare at you. And Ella collected them for years and she had an entire cabinet full. They are seriously, seriously creepy. I mean, they were in my parents' house for ages, and if you ended up staying over when there was a house full, you might end up in sort of on a camp bed in the dining room, which isn't used very much. And this cabinet full of China dolls would just stare out at you all night, which is pretty creepy. And then Ella obviously long since has moved out, got married, has a baby, and she has got the China dolls at her house somewhere. And I'm not sure where, actually. They might be boxed up.
One would hope.
But she invited me to stay, and I said, oh, I don't know, what have you done with your China dolls? And she said, oh, that's fine, they're in our room. I said, okay, that's fine, then I'll come and stay. And she said, of course, at night, they pull themselves down the corridor with their little hands, going scritch, scritch, scritch. I'm like, I'm so not ever coming to stay with you.
Well, that's that, then. Have a nice life.
Yeah, basically.
I did used to be quite afraid of dolls. It's odd because some proportions, odd proportions, I don't mind. You know, like, there are some cartoons I'll watch where I can't bear to watch them because actually they kind of disgust me.
Yeah.
It just makes me feel really sort of queasy, the way that they're drawn. Like Ren and Stimpy. I mean, there's a bunch of other reasons I probably can't watch Ren and Stimpy, to be honest. But it kind of really turns my stomach. Whereas, you know, there are other cartoons like Gravity Falls I'm totally fine with.
Yeah.
But I have a thing about elongated limbs.
You must love Salvador Dali, then.
Yeah, well, I avoid him like the plague. I find him really quite scary, to be honest. You know, he knocks on the door every now and again, but I don't let him in.
That's probably a good thing. How long has he been dead?
Please, let me melt your clocks. Go away, Salvador!
We have long-legged elephants here for you.
No, I think, and I've mentioned this book before, The Icarus Girl. There's lots of scary things in The Icarus Girl, but there was one bit which described a woman with arms that were really, really long, like they trailed on the floor when she walked.
Yeah.
And, like, she was actually, in the end, quite a nice character. Sort of, like, you see her and she hugs people and she's a motherly kind of thing and that's all fine. But, like, the first moment I read her, despite all the other creepy things that were going on, it was her. I was terrified. I remember reading it and looking up and half expecting her to come walking out of the bathroom with her hands dragging on the floor behind her. And I was just so freaked out by this image. It was just, I couldn't bear it.
Yeah.
And my housemate at one point made these little tinfoil dolls. I think I've told this story before, but she made these little tinfoil figures. And she had them crawling up the walls. She had them crawling up the wall because I'd made a fairy door out of clay. And so she had it crawling toward the fairy door. And and I was just there like, I came into the room. And Sean was sat there, and I thought he'd done it. And I said, that's not funny, you know. And he said, are you kidding? I thought you'd done it. That's why I was sitting with my back to it. And I stood there for like half a second, like, shouting loudly, like, did you do this? And I heard this other voice from far from the other room just going, sorry. Just so creepy. Just the long arms and the crawling. And I couldn't bear it.
Of course, there are others now, but
yeah, we're laughing now, but it scared the life out of me. And you know, moving aside from the sort of the long kind of limbs, if we look back at sort of old Gothic and things like that, a lot of traits that we see now, especially when it comes to vampires and monsters, are now so kind of expected. We don't really find them that creepy, but things like bright red eyes,
yeah,
or yellow eyes, that's a frightening concept. If you actually encountered someone, you know, not at Comic-Con who had bright red eyes, you'd probably tell them to go to a doctor, but you might also be a little bit alarmed.
Yeah, and once again, you're back to, well, it's the whole uncanny valley thing, isn't it? It looks like us, yeah. But it's not.
Yeah.
Which is why the Japanese robots really, really freak me out. The more lifelike they get, the more they freak me out, because you can tell there's nothing behind them yet. There's nothing behind the surface. But at the same time, they're enough that you would have to do a double take.
Yeah, exactly. And it is that people underestimate how powerful that is, that you can write an entire thing which has got kind of blood falling from the walls and limbs and spikes and screams in the night, but the thing that will get under people's skin are the things which are almost familiar. The things thereby which we let our guard down with for a moment because we think, this is the same as me. This is the same as the situation I've been in before. And because you kind of let your guard down, when you notice suddenly that it's not, that there's one small thing out of place, you suddenly become very aware that you've been lured into a trap. And maybe it even falls down to, you know, that long ago kind of thing, that the fight or flight sort of era, when, you know, you'd be maybe grazing or you know, you'd be something and everything seemed fine. And then you became aware that maybe there wasn't any bird song, or maybe that the shape of the trees looked a little bit off. And you suddenly became aware that there was something there, a snake, a tiger, or whatever. I don't know what I'm imagining.
Yeah.
But I think it calls on that instinct, which is that I have missed something and now I am in grave danger.
Yes, that sense of the world being other than it should be.
Yeah.
And actually quite a good place to start, and you'll like this because it'll let you say the F word, you know, scot-free.
Yay!
Without an F, without it contributing to the F jar. A good place to start for me would be looking at Celtic fairy tales. Now, when I first really encountered proper Celtic fairy tales, it was, you know, partly through my grandmother, but partly I got given a book of Scottish fairy tales when I was up in Scotland, when I was about 7 or 8 years old. Mm-hmm. Now, before that, we'd really been brought up, my sister and I, because one sister hadn't even arrived yet, had really been brought up on the sanitised fairy tales that the Victorians had put out. So,
yeah.
You know, it was the very, very clean versions of things like Cinderella and Beauty and the Beast and things like that. So the expectation set up in fairy tales was that if someone was very beautiful, they were probably either very wicked or very good.
Mm-hmm.
They were either heroine or the villain, villainess even. And in the end, everyone would live happily ever after. You know, evil would be vanquished. Everyone would triumph. And Celtic fairy tales are not like that at all.
Nope.
And certainly the Scottish and Welsh and Irish ones that are derived from the original Celtic myths and legends are very much not like that. And now the one I'm thinking of that I encountered when I was about 8 years old was this one. It's a man who plays the pipes. It's obviously a version of Tamlin or Thomas the Rhymer.
Mm-hmm.
And he's playing his pipes outside a fairy mound, and he's on his way to play at a wedding, but he stops to practice a bit, and, you know, moonlit night, by a fairy mound, bit of a stupid thing to do. And the queen under the hill invites him in, and of course he goes, and he entertains them, he plays for them for the entire night, and then says, well, I've got to be on my way, I must play at a wedding, and they let him out of the fairy mound, and then he finds out that 100 years has gone by, and everyone he knows is dead. And it's like, when you're used to the sanitised fairy tales that they sort of push on children, to suddenly be given that when you're 8 years old, that was like, okay, this is the uncanny then. Not that I would have had the word, but, you know.
Playtime is over, children.
It's like, guess what? Fairy tales are not nice things. Bad things happen in fairy tales. And this is when I started finding out that the fairy tales we were given, like Cinderella and various others, Sleeping Beauty, were actually not the original versions.
No. And so I guess in that case, we've created our own situation of the uncanny.
Yeah.
In kind of reverse, because we sanitized something.
Yeah, we set up an expectation of what the familiar should be, and, you know, for generations sort of indoctrinated it, and then suddenly a different source of information challenged it.
Yeah, and it is interesting because, and we can probably really blame the Victorians for this, that real refinement of good and evil, which is that good is beautiful and evil is bad. And yeah, sometimes beautiful things could be evil, but it was actually tend to be revealed that they were ugly beneath, that the beauty was just a facade. But yeah, it was that emphasis that all good things were very beautiful and all bad things were very, very ugly. Whereas in earlier mythology, the more beautiful you were, probably the more dangerous you were.
Yes. Or you were likely to end up cursed.
Yeah. Or you were likely to end up cursed, yeah. Basically, be ugly and you're fine. Woo! So yeah, I love the uncanny in books. I think it works better sometimes in books than it does in films. Though there are some very successful ways of doing the uncanny in films.
Yeah, and a recent television series as well, I found. Yeah, while we're still sort of hovering around Celtic fairy tales, it's worth looking at, instead of, this is again the Victorians, and obviously you've talked about fairies before, where the Victorians gave us these sort of almost very lissome sort of little females with wings that looked perfectly proportioned and sat on the edge of bluebells and things.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas fairies before that were not, they're more like what we think of as goblins.
Yeah.
A lot of the time. And it's again that uncanniness, the elongated limbs or the really, really short bodies or the like, over-large heads. And it's a case of this is a being that only has the vaguest idea of what humans are really supposed to look like, but are trying to take on a form that a human will understand kind of thing.
Yeah. And the other one that you see a lot of, and that's not just in Celtic fairy tales and in Celtic mythology, but in most mythologies across the world, is the cross between a human body and an animal.
Yeah.
So two things which are familiar, which have been mixed in a way that we would not expect.
Yes.
And now, sorry. now we get it all the time because we get animated sexy foxes and, you know, it's awkward for everyone. I think that actually we've kind of been sort of removed from that because we do actually have stories now of humanized animals.
Yeah, you do. And obviously, certainly in animation, you get the very human features as well.
Yeah, exactly. But if you think of it in a sort of real level, if you think of it like actually happening, I've got a story that Sean shared with me. And I think it was, a weasel. Yeah, it was a weasel. And so this farmer was sort of on his way home, you know, just whistling, all happy. And he looked across and it was either a stoat or a weasel. And he saw the stoat coming the opposite way and it was rolling an egg up the hill just with its front paws.
Yeah.
And he stopped and stared at it and the stoat weasel stopped and looked at him and then continued on its way. And the farmer went home and got his gun because he was there like, nope, that's too clever. That's too human. Because he'd never seen it before.
Yeah.
And he literally, the last minute, he was convinced not to go after this poor creature that was just doing something semi-intelligent. But it was just the fact he saw it and went, no, I don't have to deal with this today. So if you actually imagine in your head animals doing human things, or things that we associate very strongly with humans, sometimes we find it amusing, sometimes we find it amazing, but it can kind of get under your skin, especially when animals exhibit very smart, what we would consider to be very smart behaviour, or very human kind of reactions to things. It can make us quite uneasy.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think, it, you know, we say, oh, it's because we're worried that they're going to rise up against us. But I think it's because we categorize things so strongly in our minds of what we should expect from any one thing. So trees do not speak, usually. And, you know, crows don't tap dance. Usually. Yeah, we have this list of categories of what we expect from people, what we expect from animals, what we expect from nature. And when something in that list no longer adds up, it kind of sends us into disarray, because I guess on a very, very, very deep subconscious level, it probably makes you question what is real then.
Yeah, absolutely. Where are the parameters?
Yeah, because they've been pulled out from underneath you.
Yeah, definitely. I've mentioned this one before, but I keep making us sound like a couple. Not me and Madeline. Myself and my boyfriend Creature watched Fortitude recently. And as I've mentioned before, it's this town set in the Arctic Circle, where they only get a they have ice and snow pretty much all year round, and then they have almost like 30 days of darkness a year. So you have to be pretty tough to live out there. And it's this great close-knit community, and there's all these secrets and things under the surface. But the entire series, the first season that is, leaves you feeling that there's something really uncanny going on. And you can't entirely put your finger on why. Because, and even at the end of the season, I was still sort of like, well, it could be science, it could still be a bit supernatural, we don't really know.
Yeah.
Now, I don't want to give away the plot too much, because I think people should go away and watch this, it's really, really good. But something's discovered in the ice, and then people start getting ill, and they can't really put their fingers on exactly why people are getting ill.
Yeah.
It looks like mumps to start with, but it's not mumps. And you could trace it all back and say there's a causal link and it can be scientifically explained, but there are such big gaps and it's not a plotting error that you could also say there's something a bit supernatural about it as well.
Yeah. Well, it makes me think as well that the first series of Lost.
Yeah, actually. Before it started getting really big.
Before it got really weird.
Sort of jumped the shark, didn't it?
That had a lot of uncanny things. I think one of the most obvious ones, which maybe wasn't used to complete success, was the polar bear on this...
Yeah.
on this exotic island.
The first time you see it, it's like, oh my god, it's a polar bear.
What are you doing there? This is not the right desert for you. Go home. I mean, I knew the ice caps were melting, but I really didn't expect them to be melting that much. So there's another example of uncanny that really gets under my skin is Attack on Titan. And again, this is not a manga or an anime that I actually watched that much of. It just got a little bit too much for me. But the Titans in it are terrifying because they look almost human, but they have these huge mouths and these grins which are constantly plastered on their faces.
Yeah.
And it's so unnerving. It really, really is very, very unnerving. And yeah, just even thinking about them, I would not want to live in that world.
Okay, well, the one that gets me, see, I know when uncanny is done really well, because I just have existential dread for the next 3 weeks trying to solve the problem. But the one that always gets me, and you're starting off in a world, a universe where everything is already upside down, but once you accept the parameters of that universe, it's the uncanniness underneath that sort of gets me, I think, and it's 12 Monkeys.
Okay.
Which is a sci-fi, but I always think of it as a horror because it leaves me feeling horrified. And basically, it's a post-apocalyptic event. No one's really sure, but it looks like a virus has wiped out most of the human race.
Yeah, of course.
And there's a very definite underground class system. And I mean, they're literally underground. They're living underground because the surface is so polluted you can't go up there anymore. They keep sending the main character, Bruce Willis, back through time to find out what the source of the disease was so they can do short jumps back through time, and it gets more and more tangled and it turns into a predestination time paradox, which when they're done right I quite like, but most of the time people get them completely wrong, so I get annoyed with them. This is done well enough that you just get caught in this endless loop at the end of how do I solve it, because you know it's you've got this predestination time paradox where you've almost got Bruce Willis confronting his child self before the disease got released, and there doesn't seem to be any real solution because they haven't managed to solve it before once again the characters have been killed, so it's just going to happen over and over and over and over again. It's that endless loop, that's what the uncanny builds towards.
This is why I don't watch or read sci-fi.
Anyway, the most recent time I watched it, I think my boyfriend must have just like not quite heard what I said, because I said, oh, 12 Monkeys is a really good film, but it totally freaks me out. And I think what he heard was, 12 Monkeys, I really like that film. So he bought me the DVD for my birthday a few years ago. I'm like, okay, we'll watch it again then, and I can spend the next 3 weeks being really freaked out. But he pointed out something that happens at the end that is a really, really slender thread of something where they might actually have solved it, kind of thing. But it's so buried in everything else that, you know, you could still have that horrible, it's an endless loop thing.
Endless loop. Oh, now you're just freaking me out.
Yeah, so things like that. And I suppose leading on from the Celtic fairy tale thing, The Storyteller by Jim Henson. I don't know if you ever saw any of those. They're not on TV anymore.
Actually, that is ringing a bell.
And you had The Storyteller, who's this old man in a tower with his dog, which is obviously a Muppet, because it's Jim Henson.
Oh, right, yes. Yeah.
And telling fairy tales. But they're in the old sort of Celtic vein.
Yeah.
So they're really quite uncanny fairy tales. And they always leave you with this slight sense of disquiet.
Yes, I did watch a few of those. There was an Irish equivalent called the Shanahy.
I don't think I ever saw that.
I didn't either, but my partner Sean told me about it. And I kind of wish I missed it. And yeah, he told me some of the stories and one of them was about a guy who could see when death was coming for certain people, and he worked as a life insurance person, and everyone in the village knew that he could see death, but no one mentioned it. All they knew is that when he came to you and said, "Do you want to buy life insurance?" they would buy it, because he basically did that when he knew people were about to die so that he could help them out. And that one just gets under my skin, because I'm pretty sure it ends with him basically seeing the death around himself or something like that. I can't remember, but yeah, it's a little things like that. I mean, the no one tells kind of really uncanny stories quite like the Irish and the Scottish, to be honest.
No. Okay, the one that gets me, I think the English version's called Soldier Jack. Now, Soldier Jack's a very, very poor soldier, because, you know, they just were. in fairness, they weren't. They were paid a pittance. And he is travelling back to his own home village, and he helps an old woman one night. I think she's either gathering firewood or something like that, and it's very cold, and he helps her, he cuts firewood for her. And in return, she gives him a sack. And she says to him, you know, whenever you need something, tell it to get in the sack. So he's like, okay, well, thank you very much, mother, kind of thing. I'm just going to carry on now, but I'll take the sack with me. There's nothing to eat, and he's really, really hungry, and obviously there's been, you know, famine everywhere because the war's been going on so long. And he's really hungry, and he comes to a lakeside and sees three geese landing on the lake and thinks, God, I'd kill for a goose right now, but I've got nothing to catch them with. So, half laughing, half desperate, he opens up the sack and says, "Oh, you geese, get into my sack." And all three geese fly into his sack. And the story goes on from there. He calls the geese into his sack, and obviously he's got three nice geese, so I think he trades two of them. And then gradually he builds his wealth with this, as you do in fairy tales. And then sickness comes to his village, and everyone knows that the old soldier Jack has solved so many of the village's problems, so they come to him and say, you know, you've got to stop death taking so many of us. So he stays up late one night over a child who, you know, they don't think is going to make it to the morning, and he finally sees death. And they have a conversation, and then Jack pulls out his sack, no pun intended, "Death, get into my sack." And he imprisons death in the sack, and everybody stops dying, but they don't get better. So they just live. Nobody dies. And after a while, the world starts to get cluttered with people who are old and want to die, or who are sick and actually need to die. And it's the same with animals and plants and things. Winter doesn't come properly, so summer and everything doesn't really work with the harvest. Finally, everyone's saying, you've got to release death from the sack. We actually kind of need death. So he does. And death then redresses the balance, because that is what death traditionally does in fairy tales and stories. But Soldier Jack, he never ever comes near him. So Soldier Jack just gets older and older and older and more feeble and older. But death never ever comes to the man who tried to catch him in a sack and imprison him. And that's his punishment. And it's that bit, that right at the end, that idea of just being trapped in this eternal aging life forever, that really, really got me.
Well, there's actually there's another myth of something like that, which is, oh gosh, Yeah, where someone is given eternal life, but not eternal youth.
Cthonus.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
That's
the goddess
right.
fell in love with him and begged for Zeus to make him immortal, but she forgot to ask for eternal youth, so he just gets really, really old, but lives forever.
That's just uncomfortable. Ooh.
I don't remember this very well, actually. I only saw a few episodes when I was much younger. The Twilight Zone. Again, setting up a set of familiar parameters and then giving you something really, really uncanny.
Yes. And it's quite interesting because the way you can really successfully use the uncanny in visual kind of arts and in visual media is different from how you'd necessarily use it in books.
Yeah.
Where you can use the uncanny to sort of to sort of describe the atmosphere and sort of the things that kind of happen. Whereas the most successful way you can really do it in films and TV and things like that is often, as well as with plot and the like, it's often how you visually show things. And there are several very successful kind of ones. There's a sci-fi film, and I cannot for the life of me remember what it is, but it's about people who actually discover that they're sort of not actually real. They're within a computer, and which is within a computer, which is yeah, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They're artificial life or something like that. And whilst the characters are there talking and stuff like that, you notice that people who are further in the background just stop moving.
Yeah.
They're frozen until you reach them. And they're non-playable characters basically. So they just do the same thing over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And that's never addressed upon because the characters just are not conscious of it. But as a visual kind of thing, you watch the screen and you're like, something is wrong and I cannot figure out what is wrong. Something is wrong and I cannot figure out what is wrong. Until you suddenly go, why is everyone else in the background completely still? You
Yeah.
still have all the background noise, but no one is actually moving. And it's been done on purpose. And it really, the atmosphere really starts to sort of creep up on you.
Yeah, definitely.
Another successful one, which you often see done, especially in kind of thrillers and murder mystery sort of things, is that you'll have a wide shot of which is sort of focused on someone talking, and then it'll flick to something else, and then it'll come back to them, and something in the background will be gone, like a cloak will be missing,
Yeah.
or something like that. And it's often, someone has just moved, and that again, that really kind of gets to you because something has changed from the norm that you expect. And I think that these are some of the most visually, some of the most successful ways of creating the uncanny on screen without having to sort of build it up by doing something very small and very simple.
Yeah, definitely. And you do find it in a lot of the classic old films that are trying to create suspense. That they do create this sense of the uncanny quite successfully because they don't have the sort of special effects and things. They've had to think about it a bit more. I mean, I'm thinking about the old film with Ingrid Bergman in it, Gaslight. And obviously, you've got the young heiress whose husband has got stock in making her think she's mad or going mad so that he can get her basically shut up and take over her inheritance. And it's quite simple. He sort of fixes it so that the gas lights seem to flicker or seem to die down. And it's such a small thing, but the whole thing when you see it as a film is really quite creepy.
Yes, it is, and that is just so subtle.
I think there's an Agatha Christie where they I know this is weird and it's sort of not really speculative fiction, but where they started to try and imply there was something a bit supernatural going on, and that she was seeing the woman who said that she'd seen the murder, had actually been seeing ghosts and things because she couldn't have physically seen what she thought she was seeing. And I can't remember whether it's the mirror that cracked from side to side or they do it with mirrors, but it's one of those two. And they did a really good television adaptation for it.
There's another one where actually the woman herself committed the murder and was pretending there was ghosts, but then actually basically got into the point where she started to believe that there really were ghosts.
Yeah.
And again, it's very, very cleverly done. And very simple as well. The true key, I think, the true key to the uncanny is in its simplicity.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, you can have things which are very, very complex, but I think there's just a power behind having that one thing, which, because it's okay. So here's an example in daily life. You know when you are walking upstairs and you forget how many stairs there are.
Yeah.
And you go for the top stair and it isn't there.
Yeah.
Or one of the stairs is actually slightly bigger than the other and you trip and you stumble.
Yeah.
That's kind of what the uncanny is. It's the point where people are so relaxed, people feel so comfortable with kind of what's happening. They think they know what's going on and then you take it away from them.
Yeah, it's the realization that you can't take anything for granted.
Yes, exactly. Oh, gosh, I think we're running out of time.
We have come to an end there. I mean, there's a few books and things, but perhaps we'll go into it another time because I think it's quite an interesting one. That it's quite subtle.
Well, why don't we talk about one of those books?
Okay, The Bone Clocks by David Mitchell.
Mm-hmm.
And David Mitchell's one of my favourite authors. This is David Mitchell, the author, not David Mitchell, the comedian. I'm sure he's different David Mitchell. And what he's done with The Bone Clocks is he's got a shifting narrative from, I think, five different points of view. And you read a section of the book, and then you go on to the next point of view, and the next, and the next, and the next. And it's mm-hmm. clear that there is something really quite strange going on underneath. But everything is very... And, you know, the authenticity of his research and everything. The main character, Holly, it starts off in the early 80s, and she's about 16. And then you get a different character's point of view. And you see sections of her life through other characters' viewpoint and eyes. And you know there is something really, really strange going on. But you don't really get any inkling of just how strange it is until sort of like about 80% of the way through the book when you hit the fifth section.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like the entire world flips over. And it is really, really strange. And then you go back to that strange, that sense of, well, the world sort of righted itself and it's back to normal in the sixth and final section. But you've still got that lingering, well, we know there is something very, very wrong going on there. And it's sort of like psychic vampires or, you know, people extending their lives, cheating death, basically, by finding psychic children and feeding off them.
Mm.
But it's not as clear-cut as that. And you get the sense that there are these characters that are genuinely quite predatory and there's something really wrong with them. But right up until the very end, you don't know what's going on. So that's a book that does the uncanny very well.
What's the title again?
The Bone Clocks.
The Bone Clocks. I'm sorry, I'm fascinated. I'm going to have to add that to my to-be-read pile. I think it kind of brings me... people who write dreams a lot should really become familiar with the uncanny because our dreams tend to be very, very uncanny. And the key to dreams about the uncanny is that you create something which is uncanny, but that doesn't feel uncanny to you.
Yeah.
So when we dream, you know, when we wake up and try and describe a dream, it suddenly doesn't usually make that much sense. And you say, oh, you were there, except you were actually not you. You were someone else, but I knew it was you. And when you're just saying it in, you know, when you're conscious, it doesn't make any sense. But when you are dreaming, it makes total sense. And yet looking back on it, it's very uncanny because what you've got is things which feel familiar and yet actually really, really, really aren't familiar. And so I think the successful way to write a dream is to really understand the uncanny. And it goes both ways. I think if you are able to write dreams in a realistic way, you probably have a good grasp on the uncanny as well.
Yeah, and that's obviously a good place to use it if you are going to write dream sequences.
Indeed.
Or even flashbacks, actually.
Yep, true. True, true, true. The point is, you should all be using the uncanny a lot more. Freak us out. Get under our skin.
Yeah, but not 12 monkeys freak us out, you know?
No. Unless that's your thing. One thing I like is mirrors.
Yes.
Mirrors and the use of the uncanny. Mirrors are great with the uncanny, because all you have to do with a mirror is make it misbehave.
Yeah, just slightly. And mirrors are quite freaky things anyway, if you think about it.
I know someone who won't look at a mirror at night when they're going to the sort of, if they're going about the house, they just won't look at mirrors because they're worried that it won't behave.
You don't know what's going to look back at you.
Yeah. Are you even going to be in the reflection? Or are you going to be stood there watching yourself, you know?
Are you going to be subtly altered?
Yeah. So, mirrors. Always a good start. And mirrors and shadows.
On that disquieting thought.
Thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.